Hello. Welcome to Audio Journal's Radioactive Theater, a series of programs presenting outstanding radio dramas for our listening audience. For this program, RAT presents The Belle of Amherst by William Luce. The play is based on the life of poet Emily Dickinson from 1830 to 1886 and is set in her Amherst, Massachusetts home. The play makes use of her work, diaries, and letters to recollect her encounters with the significant people in her life. Family, close friends, and acquaintances. As the play opens, we see Emily Dickinson as a delicate, sensitive, and quaint woman, but with an inner strength. Her manner ranges from the childlike and whimsical to the deeply poignant. It is 1883. She is 53 years old, which in her case is not too relevant, since she appears younger than she is. Her hair is auburn, parted in the center, and pulled back. She is dressed in a simple, full-length white dress with an apron over it. Here is Barbara Wyrick as Emily Dickinson, the Belle of Amherst.
Yes, Finny, I have the tea, dear. This is my introduction. Black cake, my own special recipe. Forgive me if I'm frightened. I never see strangers and hardly know what I say. My sister, Lavinia, she's younger than I. She says I tend to wander back and forth in time. So you must bear with me. I was born December 10th, 1830, which makes me 53. Welcome to Amherst. My name is Emily Elizabeth Dickinson. Elizabeth is for my Aunt Elizabeth Currier. She's father's sister. Oh, how the trees stand up straight when they hear Aunt Libby's little boots come thumping into Amherst. She's the only male relative on the female side. Dear Aunt Libby, but I don't use my middle name anymore since I became a poet. Professor Higginson, the literary critic, doesn't think my poems are... No matter. I've had 7 poems published anonymously, to be sure, so you see why I prefer to introduce myself to you as a poet. Here in Amherst, I'm known as Squire Edward Dickinson's half-cracked daughter. Well, I am. The neighbors can't figure me out. I don't cross my father's ground to any house or town. I haven't left the house for years. The soul selects her own society, then shuts the door. Why should I socialize with village gossips? There goes one of them now, Henrietta Sweetster. Everyone knows Henny. She'd even intimidate the Antichrist. Look at her. She's strolling by the house, trying to catch a glimpse of me. Would you like that? So I give them something to talk about. I dress in white all year round, even in winter. Bridal white, Henny calls it. Dear, dear, dresses in bridal white she does every day of the blessed year. Year in, year out, disappointed in love as a girl, so I hear. Poor creature, also very sad. And her sister Lavinia, a spinster too. Didn't you know? Oh, yes, stayed unmarried just to be at home and take care of Miss Emily. 2 old maids in that big house. What a lonely life to shut yourself away from good people like us. Indeed. You should see them come to the door bearing gifts, craning their necks, trying to see over Vinnie's shoulder. But I'm too fast for them. I've already run upstairs 2 steps at a time, and I hide there until they leave. You can't imagine what they make of that. One old lady came to the door the other day to get a peek inside. I surprised her by answering the door myself. She stammered something about looking for a house to buy. To spare the expense of moving, I directed her to the cemetery. Oh, the cake. Oh, I do all the baking here at Homestead. I even bang the spice for this cake. My father always raved about my baking. He would eat no cake or bread but mine. Lovely. No, it's easy to make. The recipe, of course. It's really very simple. Now, I'll go slowly. Black cake. 2 pounds of flour, 2 pounds of sugar, 2 pounds of butter, 19 eggs, 5 pounds of raisins, 1.5 pounds of currants, 1.5 pounds of citron, 1/2 pint of brandy, oh, I never use Father's Best, 1/2 pint of molasses, 2 nutmegs, 5 teaspoons of cloves, mace, and cinnamon, oh, yes, 2 teaspoons of soda, and 1.5 teaspoons of salt. Just beat the butter and sugar together. Add the 19 eggs one at a time. Now, this is very important. Without beating, then beat the mixture again, adding the brandy alternately with the flour, soda spices, and salt that you've sifted together. Then the molasses. Now take your 5 pounds of raisins and 3 pounds of currants and citron and gently sprinkle in all 8 pounds. Slowly now as you stir. Bake it for 3 hours if you use cake pans. If you use a milk pan, as I do, you'd better leave it in the oven 6 or 7 hours. Oh, everybody loves it. Oh, I hope you will, too. Thank you. Sometimes I bake one for a neighbor, and I enclose a short note that is usually so obscure. No one can understand it. I hear my little notes are becoming collector's items in the village. People compare them to see who has the strangest one. Excuse me? We must be very careful what we say. No bird resumes its egg. That'll keep them guessing. Oh, that reminds me. I must send a note to Mrs. Hills. She'd just been admitted to the Maplewood Infirmary. Surgeons must be very careful when they take the knife. Underneath their fine incisions stirs the culprit, life. That'll cheer her up. I'm told one woman in Amherst is imitating me now, probably Clarissa Cartwright. Just what Amherst needs, another eccentric. Oh, I do have fun with them. My menagerie. I guess people in small towns must have their local characters. And for Amherst, that's what I am. But you know something? I enjoy the game. I never said this to anyone before, but I'll tell you, I do it on purpose. The white dress, the seclusion, it's all deliberate. But my brother Austin, he knows. He says, Emily, stop your posing. Austin knows me through and through as no one else does. Father and mother never understood me. And Vinny doesn't know me either. Austin and I are unlike most everyone and are therefore more dependent on each other for delight. But I do think sometimes the stories about me distress him. In a way, the stories are true. Oh, I believe in truth, but I think it can be slanted just a little. Do you know what I'm saying? Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth, superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased, with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. Words are my life. I look at words as if they were entities, sacred beings. There are words to which I lift my hat when I see them sitting on a page, and sometimes I write one. Circumference. And I look at its outlines until it starts to glow brighter than any sapphire. I hesitate which word to take when I write a poem. A poet can choose but a few words, and they have to be the chiefest words, the best words. A word is dead when it is said, some say. I say it just begins to live that day. If I read Keats, Shelley, Shakespeare, Mrs. Browning, Emily Bronte, oh, what an afternoon for heaven, when Bronte entered there, and they make my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me. I know that is poetry. Have you ever felt that way? If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only ways I know it. Is there any other way? My friend Helen Jackson, oh, you'd love her. She moved to Colorado. Helen is a fine scholar of words and a well-known writer. She has the facts, but not the phosphorescence. Phosphorescence. Now, there's a word to lift your hat to. Can you spell it? To find that phosphorescence, that light within, that's the genius behind poetry. Do you know that every one of you is, to me, a poem? You and you, each one a rare creation. I suppose that's why I love you and you love me, whether we realize it or not. I discovered that secret a long time ago about the souls of people. And I thought that being a poem oneself precluded the writing of poems, but I saw my mistake. The poet lights the lamp and then goes out himself, but the light goes on and on. Essences are marked for. No, that's not the best word. Labeled, that's better. Essences are labeled for immortality. If I can stop one heart from breaking, I shall not live in vain. If I can ease one life the aching, or cool one pain, or help one fainting robin onto his nest again, I shall not live in vain. People find it hard to believe that I had a normal childhood. They visualize instead a miniature version of me as I am now, a pint-sized little Emily, dressed all in white, lisping riddles and aphorisms and baby talk, and of course hiding from the family. Well, I guess I'm to blame for that false impression. Actually, at 15, I was a very typical amorous girl. I went to dances. I giggled my way through classes, quilted bees, and scores of parties. I was trying very hard to believe I was a ravishing beauty. I was infatuated with one dashing young man after another. Unfortunately, they didn't know it. If they did, they were smarter than I gave them credit for. I expect I shall be the belle of Amherst when I reach my 17th year. I don't doubt that I shall have perfect crowds of admirers at that age. Father's house and my garden, this is my world, and for my companions I have the hills and the sundown, and my dog, Carlo, large as myself, that my father bought me. They're better than beings because they know, but don't tell. And the noise in the pool at noon excels my piano. You see, I've never had to go anywhere to find my paradise. I found it all right here, the only world I wanted, here in Amherst, Massachusetts. Massachusetts. Now there's a word to lift your hat to. Paradise is no journey because it's within, but for that very cause it's the most arduous of journeys. I travel the road unto my soul all the time. I dwell in possibility, a fairer house than prose, more numerous of windows, superior for doors of chambers, as the cedars, impregnable of eye, and for an everlasting roof the gables of the sky. Of visitors the fairest for occupation, this, the spreading wide my narrow hands to gather paradise. Nature is the highest art, don't you think? Why, just to see the summer sky is poetry. Summer! The orchard is full of blue jays. To see them follow the hose for a drop of water is a touching sight. They won't take it if I hand it to them. They run and shriek as if they were being assassinated. But, oh, to steal it, that is bliss. In June, without fail, the circus comes to town. It passed the house last night. I watched it until 3:30 in the morning. Vinny, Vinny, Maggie, the wagons, it's here. Tell Maggie. Oh, they said hoy, hoy to their horses. Still, I feel the red in my mind, though the drums are gone. For a while, Algiers was outside my bedroom window. Yes, Algiers. I've never seen such heat. The sun beat down till today. I think everything will get ripe so it can be autumn tomorrow. Oh, how I love the beginning of school each year. My girlfriends and I had such times together. Social graces with Miss Woodbridge. Knees straight, girls. Shoulders back. Very good, Miss Dickinson. Thank you, Miss Woodbridge. Do you hear those bells? That's the First Congregational Church. A funeral. It must be Jenny Hitchcock's mother. So there's one orphan more. Vinnie went to the service, just got back. She said while the minister prayed, a hen with her chicks came up and tried to fly into the window. I suppose the dead lady used to feed them and they wanted to bid her goodbye. I don't know why it is, but it doesn't seem to me that I shall ever cease to live on earth. I can't imagine, with the farthest stretch of my imagination, my own death scene. This me that walks and works must die some fair or stormy day. It's not that I'm afraid to die. Death is an old friend to me. I made his acquaintance in my childhood. So many friends died young and were carried past our house to the burial ground. Ellen Mary Kingman, the Packard girls, Abby Ann Haskell, James Francis Billings. There's been a death in the opposite house as lately as today. I know it by the numb looks such houses have alway. The neighbors rustle in and out, the doctor drives away. A window opens like a pod, abrupt, mechanically. Somebody flings a mattress out. The children hurry by, they wonder if it died on that. I used to, when a boy. The minister goes stiffly in as if the house were his, and he owned all the mourners now and little boys besides. And then the milliner and the man of the appalling trade to take the measure of the house. There'll be that dark parade of tassels and of coaches soon. It's easy as a sign, the intuition of the news in just a country town. Poor Jenny. Now, what was I telling you? Oh, yes, the clock stopped this afternoon during a thunder shower. Made it seem like Judgment Day. I never knew how to tell time by the clock till I was 15. Father thought he had taught me, but I didn't understand. And I was afraid to say I didn't, and afraid to ask anyone else, lest he should know. Can you imagine never knowing what time it was? Thank goodness for twilight. Father never kissed us goodnight in his life. I know he loved us, but, oh, he was so austere. Why, he hardly ever smiled. I remember the day we went to the photographer to have his picture taken. That poor photographer, trying to be cordial and put Father at ease. He said, Squire Dickinson, could you smile a little, please? Father said, I am smiling. You see, he looks like a bear. He didn't approve of Santa Claus and all such prowling gentlemen. Father was the only one in the house to say damn. Someone in every family ought to say damn, of course. And when he said it, he meant it. Why, if his newspaper was ever misplaced, damn! No one else was allowed to say it but Father. It was absolutely forbidden. Father forbade many things. When my sister Vinnie was a girl, she enjoyed showing off her pretty white shoulders by wearing her summer frock quite low. About here, it was the fashion. And then she'd languish about the house, looking dreamy-eyed, primping in front of the mirror, running to the window every time a boy walked by the house. Hello, Benjamin. Father could only take so much of this. Then he'd bark at her, Lavinia, don't be so affected. Put on a shawl. And poor Vin would flounce dramatically out of the room and stomp up the steps to her room and slam the door. Bang! She pouted the rest of the day. Trouble was, she was even prettier when she pouted. But Father was, oh, so proper, very demanding and flexible. That's why any show of leniency or understanding on his part would disarm us completely. I remember when he discovered I was writing till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. But, Father, I thought you were asleep. No, I didn't notice the time. Oh, 2 o'clock. Is it that late? But this is the only time the house is quiet, Father, except for Vinnie, and she snores like a poker and shovel at a pair of tongs. Yes, Father, I know you have a rule about early rising, but I haven't missed one morning, have I? Tired? I do? Well, I was writing. Yes. Good night, Father. Just a poem, Father? Now? Out loud? To make a prairie. A prairie, Father. To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee. One clover and a bee and reverie. The reverie alone will do if bees are few. Another one? Yes, Father, I do. Excuse me, I finished one's in my desk. I'll tell you how the sun rose, a ribbon at a time. The steeples swam in amethyst. The news like squirrels ran. The hills untied their bonnets. The bobolinks begotten. Then I said softly to myself, that must have been the sun, but how he set, I know not. There seemed a purple stile that little yellow boys and girls were climbing all the while, till when they reached the other side, a dominie in gray put gently up the evening bars and led the flock away. Cancel the rule for me? Then I can sleep late in the morning? Oh, thank you, Father. See what I mean? The first time we parted, 1847, I was 16. I graduated from Amherst Academy and entered Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, which was run by a dragon. Oh, I wanted to tell you about her. Mary Lyon ran the school, a noble lady, sometimes known as the dragon. I liked Miss Lyon, even though she laid down strict rules for her girls. Unfortunately, her main concern was for our spiritual health. We were classified in three categories. We were either professed Christians, that was Jane Gridley's group, we had hope, that was Olivia Coleman's group, or we were without hope, and naturally, I was in charge of that group. After Miss Lyon made a vigorous appeal for converts, the without hopes were reduced considerably. I'll never forget it. One evening we impenitent girls were invited by Miss Lyon to a meeting in Room B, the dungeon, and we were told to bring the Bible. I told Olivia this would happen, that Miss Lyon would ask everyone who desired to be employed in service to Christ to rise at the meeting and declare herself. Courage, Emily! Good evening, Miss Lyon. Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Lyon, but I can't rise. I know I'm the only one left without hope, but the Spirit hasn't moved me yet. Yes, ma'am, I desire to be good. Yes, I do want to please my parents, but I'm not yet persuaded to be a Christian. Oh, I appreciate your offer of mercy, ma'am, and I know the world is sinful and wicked, but the path of duty doesn't look, well, it doesn't look very attractive to me. But I have read the Bible, Miss Lyon, Old and New Testaments. Well, I thought at first it was an arid book, but then I found it wise and a bit merry. Merry, yes, ma'am. M-E-R-R-Y. She did look like a dragon. I think it was the nose. But I mustn't laugh at Miss Lyon, for I believe she had a pure heart, and that is the important thing, isn't it? Perhaps the kingdom of heaven's changed. I hope the children there won't be new fashion when I come and laugh at me and stare. I hope the Father in the skies will lift his little girl, old-fashioned, naughty, everything, over the stile of pearl. I didn't return to Holyoke the following year. You might say I wore out my welcome with Miss Lyon, and Father wanted me home besides. He said it was for my health, but I think Father was lonely. Austin was soon to leave for college, and Father couldn't bear to have the family separated. More than one away at a time was too much for him. All the while Austin was at home, they'd do nothing but fight. But the minute they were separated, they became devoted friends. There was no living for whom Father had such respect as for my brother Austin. Oh, but no one missed him more than I did. I've always been intense about relationships. At times my love overwhelms people, and it puzzles me. My business is to love. It's dangerous to love as I do. Bliss is so unnatural, don't you think? The path is overgrown with weeds now. I guess it's best to abandon paths when you find they lead nowhere. In the parlor, we always met for morning prayers as far back as childhood. Everyone in the family was religious, except me, and they addressed an eclipse every morning whom they called Our Father. I can still hear Father say in a most militant way, I say unto you, ooh, it always gave me a chill. Why is religion made so grim, so dull? Why should we be made to feel so guilty? Sermons, sermons, sermons. I only heard one sermon that I really liked, and that was when the Reverend Dwight preached on unbelief. Sermons on unbelief always did attract me. It was on a sweltering July Sabbath that I decided to stop attending church altogether. Well, I was old enough to make that decision. I was almost 30. I came home very hot and faded, having witnessed a couple of baptisms, 3 admissions to church, a supper of the Lord, and some other minor transactions, including the sermon, wheezed by Reverend Leland. Make a joyful noise. Unto the Lord, all ye lands, and come before his presence with singing. Singing indeed, poor Reverend Leland. Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home, with a bobolink for chorister and an orchard for a dome. Some keep the Sabbath in surplus. I just wear my wings. Instead of tolling the bell for church, our little sexton sings. God preaches a noted clergyman, and the sermon is never long. So instead of getting to heaven, at last I'm going all along. In the name of the bee, and of the butterfly, and of the breeze, amen. Oh, you agree with me. When the family went to church, I was never alone. God was sitting right there, looking into my very soul. How do you spend your evenings? Vinny and I read the Springfield Republican every night. I read the news aloud while she sews. Vinny has an odd liking for those stories of accidents where trains meet each other unexpectedly, or gentlemen in factories get their heads cut off quite informally. The author relates them in such a sprightly way. Vinny finds the stories quite attractive. She was disappointed last night that there weren't more accidents. Oh, here's one you love, Vinny. Train hits woman on Mill River Trestle. Cornelius Snell, 54, Snell, was killed last Wednesday by the Belchertown Express as she struggled vainly to free her foot from a railroad switch. Her foot, Vinny! Engineer Grover W. Putnam declared, "By the time I saw the poor lady and her dog, it was too late." Yes, Vinny. She leaves her husband, Noah L. Snell, and 8 children. 8 little Snells. Oh, the dog survived. It jumped clear. No, Vinny. The casket was closed. She was hit by a train. Services were held already, it says, last Friday, Hembley and Son in Springfield. Some 60 attended. Her children are planting an evergreen in her memory near the spot. Isn't that sweet, Vinny? I wonder why she didn't take off her shoe. Oh, I suppose she tried, but trains are so fast these days. Vinny. Oh, she's asleep. Speaking of trains, there wasn't a more exciting day in Amherst than the day of the railroad decision in 1852. It made all the headlines. Father was really satisfied with himself. He had fought for the railroad to come into Amherst. It seemed like a fairy tale. Most miraculous event in our lives. The day the train finally arrived was called New London Day. It was hot and dusty, but nobody cared for that. Father was, as usual, chief marshal of the day. He went marching around the town like Mr. Amherst himself, with New London at his heels, like some old Roman general on a triumph day. I sat out there in Professor Tyler's woods and saw the train move off. It's fall, and you know what New England autumns are like. Amherst is going to Eden, and the moon rides like a girl through a topaz town. Well, Vinny says that autumn is one long chore. Can you imagine? She's out there now, picking apples for cider. Oh, the ladder! Vinny, be careful on that ladder. It's broken. Vinny's always falling off of something, but she's practical. She knows where everything is in this house, from a lost quotation to last year's muffler. Vinny wears white cotton stockings even though everyone else is wearing black. She thinks her feet will be poisoned by the dye in the black stockings. Vinny sleeps by my side. Her care is in some sort motherly. But if we had come up for the first time from two wells where we had been bred, her astonishment wouldn't be great at some things, I say, like Father was. Mother was different. Mother didn't care for thought. Consequently, she never listened to what I said. We all lived together like friendly and absolute monarchs here at Homestead. Did you read the Atlantic Monthly? Well, in the April issue, 1862, an article appeared inviting young writers to submit their work. "Charge your style with life," said the author, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. This was what I was waiting for. My sister-in-law, Sue, agreed. We spent days trying to find just the right poems to send, but Sue thought Father would disapprove. No, he'll approve soon enough when my poems bring honor to his name. Now find one that's good contrast to the other three, and I'll finish this letter. But the letter is important, too. No, I'm not going to sign it. Isn't that humble of me? Oh, of course, but on a little card slipped into the poems. Well, he'll find it. He'll look for it. Emily Dickinson. No, E. Dickinson. Mysterious. It is provocative, isn't it? Ought to whet his curiosity, I'd say. And then when he reads my poems, won't he go wild? Do you think I should send more than four poems? How about 6 or 10? I taste a liquor never brewed from tankards scooped in pearl. Not all the vats upon the Rhine yield such an alcohol. Inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords turn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce their drams, I shall but drink the more, till seraphs swing their snowy hats and saints to windows run to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. Oh, I know, Sue, you're right, too giddy, but I love it. How about the pedigrees of honey does not concern the bee, a clover any time to him, his aristocracy. Oh, no. A bird came down the walk he did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in half and ate the fellow raw. Perfect. Mr. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Atlantic Monthly, Washington and School Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Oh, now we must throw away these scraps of paper. No one must know that the famous and mysterious E. Dickinson writes second and third drafts of her letters. Professor Higginson answered my letter, but not in the way I had hoped. I thanked him for the surgery. It wasn't as painful as I supposed. He did ask to see more poems, and I sent them. I wrote him often. He even began calling him my preceptor.
No, my preceptor.
Oh, my
And I sent him.
And I sent them. I wrote him off and even began calling him my preceptor, and myself his scholar. 8 years of correspondence, 8 years of putting my hopes on the shelf. And then when I was 40, the incredible happened. Thomas Wentworth Higginson was coming to Amherst. Face to face at last. Now we can accomplish something. I look forward to meeting with you and will come directly for my visit with President Stearns at the college. He says the 15th. Oh, dear friend, I will be at home and glad. I've been so afraid. It's like being terrified of midnight when I was a child. But now it's time to smooth the hair and get the dimples ready and wonder we could care for that old, faded midnight that frightened but an hour. He's coming to Amherst at last. It seems I'm going to be famous. Oh, Sue, I've got the most glorious news. Wait till you hear. He's coming. Maggie, watch for the coach. I'll be upstairs. Oh, surely this is the day. Maggie, when he comes to ask him to wait in the hall. Oh, it's almost time. I wonder how long he'll stay. Oh, what to say? Oh, Mr. Higginson, how is dear Mrs. Higginson? Good noon, Professor Higginson. How is Mrs. Higginson? Enchanted, Mr. Higginson. How is sweet Mrs. Higginson? Another confinement. Sherry, it's Father's best. Yes, August is a glorious month. Oh, please do sit. Oh, Mr. Higginson, how droll. I wish I thought of that. Oh, how witty. My favorite books. Oh, let me see. Jane Eyre, I loved. And The Mill on the Floss. And, of course, your inspired novel, Malbone. How did you do it? Oh, a coach? It's stopping. Oh, he's taller than I thought. And so imposing. Maggie, the door. Oh, courage, Emily. Mr. Higginson... And I to meet you. Oh, how long are you going to stay? Oh, what I mean is, why has it taken 8 years? Oh, I know you've been so busy. And then you were away in the war, the Civil War, wasn't it? War to me is so oblique. I can't grasp it. My wars are laid away in books. But now, to the real purpose of your visit, I've been waiting to hear from your own lips what you are planning for my poems. I have them right here, all the ones I've sent you. These are the first four, and here are the latest ones. I've bound them together. Oh, this one. Oh, I'll tell you how the sun rose. This was Sue's choice. Sue is my sister-in-law. That's her house over there. It wasn't what I would have chosen, but perhaps for publication it's more appropriate, more appealing to the reading public. But you will be the best judge of that, Mr. Higginson. Now, I have many more that you might feel would be better in a printed collection. Many, oh, well, over 1,000 you've never even read. Enough for several volumes, I should think. Oh, and I would prefer Morocco bound. Oh, dear. I must apologize, Mr. Higginson. I'm not giving you a chance to say anything. But could you tell me how to grow, or is it unconveyed, like melody or witchcraft? Well, no matter. Please feel free to choose the poems you think are best for a book. And as for publishers, I'll rely solely upon your judgment. After all, you are my preceptor. But my meter is new, experimental, not spasmodic. Bad rhymes? Oh, no, you don't understand what I'm trying to... If I could only explain. Uncontrolled? But, Mr. Higginson, when I try to organize, my little force explodes. But surely a publisher will recognize. Surely... A great hope fell. You heard no noise. The room was within. A cunning wreck that told no tale and let no witness in. A not admitting of the wound until it grew so wide that all my life had entered it, and there were troths besides... Closing of the simple lid that opened to the sun until the tender carpenter perpetual nail it down. I still send him poems, but always from his polite replies I get the uneasy feeling that they end up in some dusty drawer in his office. I can talk about this now, but oh, when I heard Mr. Higginson's words, I became ill. I understand another poet met with the same disappointing reception from Mr. Higginson, but he didn't give up as I did here. He got his poems published somehow, and his book has gone through 9 editions already. Mr. Higginson says his poems are absolutely scandalous. His name? Walt Whitman. Perhaps no one will ever read my poems. They seem to me like an undelivered letter lost in transit. Destiny is strange, like the warbler that I found on a bush at the foot of the garden. Why sing, I said, since nobody hears? My business is to sing in a way it rose. My business is to sing. What difference does it make if no one listens? Perhaps you laugh at me. Perhaps the whole United States are laughing at me, too. I can't stop for that. Just to have been made alive is so chief a thing. All else inevitably adds, I find ecstasy in living. The mere sense of living is joy enough. Take all away from me, but leave me ecstasy. 1 October, my rye and Indian bread won 2nd prize at the cattle show. 2nd prize was 75 cents. And in case you missed the newspaper, my heliotropes won honorable mention. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody, too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, to tell your name the lifelong day to admiring bog. Binny always said that my withdrawal into seclusion was only a happen. I suppose my not marrying was only a happen, too. Vin received an offer of marriage once. Oh, yes, she did. Vinny did not give up marriage to remain with me. Don't you listen to that, Henry Sweetster. Vin never speaks of marriage anymore, but I think she lives much of the time in the state of regret. My country is truth. I don't regret my loneliness. I accept the pattern of life as it came to me, or as I caused it to be. I'd have let Vinny go, but she'd never let me go. No, in her mind, my presence justifies the day-to-day boredom of her life. I think it has even become a kind of martyrdom. One summer day, I was in the garden with my Canterbury bells. A man who secretly loved me came to Amherst to take me away. Father and mother were gone for the afternoon, and Vinny was terrified at the thought of losing me. She became hysterical. I could hear her screaming at him all the way out here. Vinny, Vinny, get control of yourself. He's in Father's library. But I didn't know he was coming. No, no, we had no such plans. Believe me, I would have told you. He said that. He wants me to leave with him today, now. I don't know. I have to think. Please, I'm 42. Does that make me foolish? Vinny, stop screaming, he'll hear. Look at me, I love you. I love Father and Mother. I don't want to hurt anyone, but I've got to decide this myself. Vinny, where are you going? Come back. She ran like a raving lunatic over to the evergreens and came back dragging Sue. By the time they came hurtling through the kitchen door, my friend was gone. I sent him away. I can't tell you his name. Forgive me. He was married. But I'll never get over Vinny. She acted as if were the end of the world. And even though she was sorry for the things she said, do you know she turned right around and did the same thing last year when Judge Otis P. Lord proposed to me? Just because he was 18 years older than I, Vinny once again went absolutely mad. Of course, she changed her tune when he died in March. Why is she so self-righteous? I'll never know. Austin is having an affair right now with... Oh, I shouldn't tell you this. Well, he is. With Professor Todd's wife, Mabel, and Vinny doesn't object to that at all. In fact, she carries messages between them in her sewing basket. She acts like a middle-aged Cupid. But it was Judge Lord's niece, Abby Fowley, who had the most to say. She was disgusted by our courtship. After the judge died, she called me a little hussy with loose morals, said I'm crazy about men, and insane besides. Even one of those is bad enough, but all three? Abby looks a little tart, but Otis said she makes excellent apple pies. I guess she knows that Otis was paying me attention while his wife was still alive. Does that shock you? Oh, I know I'm plain and small like the wren, but my hair is bold like the chestnut burr, and my eyes like the cherry in the glass that the guest leaves. I never had but one picture taken of myself when I was 17. Plain. Now, there's a word not to lift your hat to. I know what people say. Poor Emily, the only kangaroo among the beauties. Is it any wonder I keep it in a drawer? But I'll have you know, plain or not, I had more than one suitor, and they were all married and older than I. But there was really only one. Only one. It was in Philadelphia years ago that I first saw Charles Wadsworth. I was 24. I hadn't planned to tell you this. Vinny and I had visited Father in Washington while he was a congressman. On the way home, we stayed 2 weeks with the Colemans in Philadelphia. We attended the Presbyterian church where Mr. Wadsworth was minister. When I first laid eyes on him that Sunday morning, it was as if heaven's own lightning struck me. Here before me was a Christ-like man. He seemed like Gabriel standing before the congregation. When I walked out of the church into the brilliant morning, the light in my heart was shining even brighter. His voice haunted me. I couldn't shake off the enchantment even after I returned to Amherst. I wrote to him at first, hesitant, a cautious letter asking about spiritual things, redemption, immortality. And finally, in his answers, I detected a response not like my own emotions, but more subtle, sensitive, hidden. It's an exquisite experience to love someone in a bodiless way, like fleshless lovers forever one. Such love was the limit of my dream, the focus of my prayer. It made me different from before, as if I breathed superior air. Oh, wild nights, were I with thee. Wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart. Rowing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but more tonight in thee? I called him master. I spoke with him only twice in my life, 20 years apart. The first time in 1860. He came to me again 3 years ago. Again his voice is at the door. I feel the old decree. I hear him ask the servant for such as one as me. I take a flower as I go, my face to justify he never saw me in his life. I might surprise his eye. I cross the hall with mingled steps. I, silent, pass the door. I look on all this world contains, just his face, nothing more. Where did you come from? Ah, the pulpit to the train, but why didn't you tell me you were coming so I could have it to hope for? Oh, then you didn't know yourself. You just came. How long was your journey? 20 years. Yes, it has been that long, hasn't it? But I'm older too, master. But the love is the same. Oh, no. Say I may wait for you. I waited a long time, master. But I can wait more. Till my hazel hair is dabbled and you carry the cane. Then I can look at my watch, and if the day is too far declined, we can take the chances for heaven. Will you come to Amherst again? You can't? I understand. Yes, I'm content. I shall always be content now. Goodbye, master. It's easier to look behind at a pain than to see it coming. When the best is gone, I know that other things are not of consequence. The heart wants what it wants, or else it doesn't care. Last year in April, my master died. Will there really be a morning? Is there such a thing as day? Could I see it from the mountains if I were as tall as they? Has it feet like water lilies? Has it feathers like a bird? Is it brought from famous countries of which I have never heard? Oh, some scholar, oh, some sailor, oh, some wise man from the skies, please to tell a little pilgrim where the place called morning lies. Yes, I still write poetry, but not as much as I used to. There are so few listeners, and those who should be the best listeners, like Professor Higginson, are deaf. But even yet, when I see a tall, pale snowstorm stalking through the fields and bowing at my window, I find I must translate my feeling into poetry. I sometimes put both hands on the windowpane and try to think how birds fly and imitate and fail. I can make a balloon of a dandelion, but the fields are gone. I talk of all these things with my dog, and his eyes grow meaning and his shaggy feet keep a slower pace. Animals have a natural, simple wisdom. Except chickens, of course. At present, we have 24 invalid hens who do nothing so vulgar as lay an egg. Did I tell you that my father loved animals? Well, he did. He had beautiful horses. During his last winter, 9 years ago, there were several snowstorms, and the birds were so frightened and cold, they sat by the kitchen door. Father went to the barn in his slippers and came back with a breakfast of grain for each and hid himself while he scattered it, lest it embarrass them. Ignorant of the name or fate of their benefactor, their descendants are singing this afternoon. The last afternoon that my father lived, though with no premonition, I preferred to be with him and invented an absence for mother, Vinny being asleep. He seemed pleased, as I often stayed with myself, and remarked as the afternoon withdrew, he would like it not to end. His pleasure almost embarrassed me, and my brother coming, I suggested they walk. Next morning I woke him for the train and saw no more. We were eating our supper the 15th of June, and Austin came in. He had a dispatch in his hand, and I saw by his face we were all lost, though I didn't know how. He said that Father was very sick and he and Vinny must go. The train had already gone. While horses were dressing, news came. He was dead. Father doesn't live with us now. He lives in a new house. Though it was built in an hour, it is better than this. He hasn't any garden, because he moved after gardens were made. So we took him the best flowers. And if we only knew he knew, perhaps we could stop crying. Though it is many nights, my mind never comes home. At the funeral, Austin leaned over the coffin and kissed Father's forehead and said, "There, Father, I never dared that while you were living." Now the house is so quiet with just Vinny and me. Since Father's death, I've worried about Vinny. She says the strangest things. She treats me as if I were a child and she my nursemaid. Oh, we had a terrible fire in Amherst on the 4th of July at night, and Vinny tried to make me believe it was only the holiday fireworks. She kept saying, "Emily, it's only the 4th of July." Well, I know a fire when I see one, and what a night that was for Mr. Frank and his noble fire brigade. It was lighter than day for a while. People running up and down Main Street shouting. It was like a theater night in London, and Mother slept through it all. Vinny's only the 4th of July. I shall always remember. I think she'll tell me that when I die, to keep me from being afraid. A year after Father died, Mother had a stroke in her room, and she never walked again. I suspect Mother was afraid of dying. She was always avoided talking about it. One night, Austin and I were talking about the extension of consciousness after death, and Mother told Vinny afterward she thought it was very improper. Mother's dying almost stunned my spirit. She slipped from our fingers like a flake gathered by the wind and is now part of the drift called the infinite. This was the way she died. And when her breath was done, took up her simple wardrobe and started for the sun, her little figure at the gate, the angels must have spied, since I could never find her upon the mortal side. You see, we were never intimate as mother and children while she was our mother. But minds in the same ground meet by tunneling, and when she became our child, the affection came. Hold your parents tenderly, for the world will seem a strange and lonely place when they're gone. Oh, I wish I were just a blade of grass. Then all these problems of dust wouldn't terrify me. Why do we cling to the body, to this little frame? Why are we afraid to let go, or sad when others do? If my own machinery should get slightly out of gear. Please, someone stop the wheel, for I know that with belts and bands of gold, I shall whiz triumphant on the new streams. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land, and so the strangers see, yet never an extremity, it asked a crumb of me. But there are the children, thank God for that. They keep my imagination keen and alive. Austin and Sue gave me a niece and two nephews. Ned and Martha are the oldest. Little Gilbert was born when Ned was 14. October is a mighty month, for in it, little Gilbert died at 8 years. Typhoid. Not my little Gib. I see him in the star and meet his sweet velocity in everything that flies. The little boy we laid away never fluctuates, and his dim society is companion still. His last cry in delirium was, "Open the door! Open the door! They're waiting for me!" Quite used to his commandment, his little aunt obeyed. Who were waiting for him? All we possess, we would give to know. All this and more. So is there more, dear friends? More than love and death? Tell me its name. 8 Saturday noons ago, I was making my black cake with Maggie, dear Maggie, when I saw a great darkness coming and knew no more until late at night. I woke to find Austin and Vinny and a strange physician, a Dr. Bigelow, bending over me and supposed I was dying or had died. All was so kind and hallowed. I had fainted and laid unconscious for the first time in my life. What flower did Austin plant on Gilbert's grave? Oh, yes, lilies of the valley. On fathers and mothers it was damson hawthorn, I remember. When it shall come my turn, I want a buttercup. Surely the grass will give me one. I told Vinny I want to be carried a small white coffin out the back door of homestead into the blue beloved air through my garden and father's barn and out over the meadows of Amherst to the burial ground. Oh, I can hear Vinny say, "Don't talk like that, Emily." But I say, "Don't be afraid, dear Vinny. It's only the 4th of July." Life is short, isn't it, when one is done? I wonder, is there not another? And then, if God is willing, perhaps we are neighbors again. I wonder if I ever dreamed, or if I'm dreaming now. I cannot tell how eternity seems. It sweeps around me like a sea, and this world is such a little place, just the red in the sky before the sun rises. So let us keep fast hold of hands, please, that when the birds begin, none of us be missing. The name they dropped upon my face with water in the country church. Emily Elizabeth is finished using now, and they can put it with my dolls, my childhood, and the string of spools I finished threading. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children played, their lessons scarcely done. We passed the fields of gazing grain, we passed the setting sun. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, but each feels shorter than the day. I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. Oh, it's 6 o'clock, and I promised Vinny I'd peel the apples. You know, our visit was easier than I thought it would be. We were very seldom to have guests anymore. Coming, Vinny, but one more thing. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me, the simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. Oh, and when you make my cake, please tell me how you like it. And when next we meet, I'll give you my recipe for gingerbread. Ah, gingerbread, now there's a word to lift your hat to. Vinny, I'm here.
We
We hope you enjoyed our presentation of The Belle of Amherst, starring Barbara Wyrick. This program was produced and directed by Katherine Thornton and Erica Slater. Tune in next time for Radioactive Theater, a production of Audio Journal.